Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, in today's episode, we're going to explore the role of education in helping people to make sustainable food choices and tackle a sustainable food industry. A National Food Strategy Youth Engagement report found that young people they spoke to mostly had a very basic understanding of sustainability, and some simply preferred not to think about the effects of their food choices at all. And it's not just young people. A Food Standards Agency poll found only 48% of consumers believe they know what a sustainable diet consists of. So as concerns around the food industry's impact on climate change deepen, how is this lack of understanding affecting sustainability? What role does education have to play in creating the next generation of sustainability consumers and food industry workers? And should it be up to the consumer to drive that change, or does the food industry need to take some responsibility? Well, with me to discuss this are two fantastic guests. Carl Edwards is Director of Education and Public Engagement at LEAF, an organisation that promotes sustainable food and farming. Hello there, Carl.
Hello, Stefan.
Great to have you with us. We've also got Verity Jones, Associate Professor of Education at the University of the West of England, Bristol. Hello there, Verity.
Hi there.
And we're hoping also to hear later on from Rosalind Rathouse, who is founder of the Cookery School at Little Portland Street. But first of all, Verity, can you just lay down the groundwork here for us? Why is there a need for education on sustainability in the food industry?
I think that's a really good question, Stefan. And I think I'll go back to what you said in the introduction about how we know that young people and generally people don't know much about sustainability and food systems. But also people are quite reticent to engage with that. And lots of research that I've been involved with and others around the world have been involved with have looked at how sustainability and climate change are impacting our mental health and well-being. And I think a lot of that reticence and uncertainty and fear and anxiety is all linked with, crikey, we're bombarded all of the time with these issues that are coming out of our media, that are coming into our social networks, it's really scary. And that anxiety is totally understandable in the circumstances. And I think education is part of the way in which we need to use in order to navigate these issues. Education is the way in which we can look for hopeful futures. We can look for those good ways, that those enabling ways that are already in process that we can learn from and look back at, and then hopefully allow people to think about, well, what's the future that we want to see and how can we be part of that? Because what we don't want is people to think, oh, crikey, it's all on me. I'm the generation where this is all happening. Or if you're a really young person, you're the generation, you know, it used to be the trope of this next generation, they're the ones that are going to sort it out. And we really need to move away from that and think about our whole population of working towards thinking about the food system and how we can be more sustainable together as a whole community.
So this is already quite dramatic and surprising for me. I never thought I'd hear the word reticence being used here. So the subject is overwhelming for them. I mean, I wonder then, is education partly to blame for this? Has the wrong approach been taken so far and brought us to this point where you've gone, panic everybody, and so people have gone, I don't want to think about it. Is that the nub of it?
I'm involved, we call it pedagogy, so the way in which things are taught, and I'm involved with a lot of the development of climate change pedagogies and sustainable pedagogies. And traditionally what has happened is that we have gone, here is all the information, here is all of the facts, now deal with it. Yeah. And what we're now saying is actually, yes, we need that information. That's really important. We can't make choices unless we have that information. But we also need, one, time to think about how that is impacting mental health and well-being. We need to have that time in order to do that. We also need time to look at best practice and good news stories so that we aren't left feeling helpless. So good news stories are really, really important. And then finally, we also need time within that in order to think about, well, how can we as individuals, and at those different scales, individuals, local community, regional, national, international, engage with the processes that we might be able to see change. So our education needs to be reframed around these more hopeful pedagogies rather than just talking about the doom and gloom and, you know, that's it.
So aspirational rather than apocalyptic would work. Who knew? Okay, so Carl, at Leaf, you've collected data which suggests that young people have a limited understanding of sustainability in the food industry. Tell us a bit more about what you found.
So over the last 10 months, we've worked with 2,500 young people from across the UK, aged 12 to 19. Originally, it was through online surveys, and we worked with the School of Sustainable Food and Farming and McDonald's and their agricultural team to develop this research. And as part of that, we've run 16 on-farm workshops, 8 in-school workshops, and 8 online workshops. And all of this is to understand young people's beliefs, value, interest in the agri-food industry as a whole. So one, would they even be interested in a career, for example, in our sector? Secondly, how do they picture themselves as a conscious consumer? Are they a conscious consumer? Do they not want to think about being a consumer at all? Thirdly, sustainable food production. And then finally, how we improve diverse voices and inclusivity within the agri-food industry more widely. Now, what we saw, yes, there is a disconnect absolutely with young people in understanding sustainable food production and understanding those food choices. However, there is a genuine interest and passion there. So we saw almost 90% of those that we worked with said that they would like to know more around the food system. The other, I think it was 12% that came back, said they already felt they had a good understanding. So yes, there's a disconnect, but there is absolutely this desire to learn more, to understand more. When we asked young people as a consumer, you know, 12 to 19 year olds, some of them will be consumers already. We said, for us, how would you rank different criteria when you go into the shops and you buy your food, for example? And as all consumer research would tell us, number one, price. Number two, convenience, jointly with taste. And number three, environment. Immediately you think, oh, brilliant, the environment is in the top three. Well, actually, if you look at the percentages, the environment is in the lower percentile, even though it comes third.
Yeah.
So we work with those young people. We take them out onto farm. We look at that practical action as what are our food producers actually doing on the ground to be more sustainable. In terms of Leaf, we're an international organisation and we promote integrated farm management and we promote sustainable food production. 48% of UK fresh fruit and vegetables are already grown to the Leaf Mark standard. So grown to a sustainable standard that is internationally recognised. Through the commitment with different retailers within the UK, both international supply base and UK supply base, that's going to be 85%. And what young people are telling us from this research is they actually have trust and they value supermarkets, they value retailers, they value big brands, and they believe that those are making those sustainable food choices for them before it gets to the shelf. Now, what they're telling us, though, is, great, we believe them. At this moment in time, young people are saying, we believe we have trust in our food system in the UK. But they're saying, we're going to hold retailers and brands feet to the fire in the future, because actually what we want to see is, how are we now empowered to make those food choices when we're at the shop, we're in the shop floor, and we're having a look, how do we know that this product is more sustainable than this product? How do we know? And actually, very quickly, the question we're asked when we talk about 48% of UK fresh fruit and veg being grown sustainably, they come back and go, does that mean 52% isn't? And what choices do I need to make then? Which is great. They're the conversations we want.
Yeah. So Verity, I mean, are there any studies that show that, I mean, because this is clearly a very difficult area, and we're, you know, obviously we're interested in outcomes because then we can spend money and put our effort into the right places. Are there studies that show that any type of sustainability education does translate directly into sustainable choices?
With lots of education research, the long-term impact has been really difficult to measure because you get funding to do a bit of research. And then you do that research over perhaps 2 or 3 years, perhaps 4 years, which is a really long term. But actually, we need to see impact. And I can see Carl's laughing in the background. We need to see impact over a decade, over 2 decades, and see actually what's working. Because we might be working on really good projects And then they're lost because the funding's been left and we can't return to those participants to see what's going on. Yeah. But we do know, as Carl said, that young people, not only in that study of Carl's and Leif's, but also the work that's been done by Teach the Future, the work that I've done in Wales as well, all of this is pointing to young people want to learn more about sustainability, want to learn more about climate change, whether it's to do with food systems or to do with everything. And that's great. And it's now finding, well, OK, so as you said, what's the best way of doing it? We have got changes in the curriculum in certain parts of Britain. So reference to climate change and sustainability was taken out of the primary national curriculum in 2013. There is no reference to it whatsoever. However, if we look to Wales, their new curriculum has now embedded ethical citizenship and climate change and sustainability within the very core of that curriculum. So teachers are now having to engage and enable that learning. They're having to look towards getting more subject knowledge about these areas, look to what pedagogies and teaching, kind of ways of teaching that are more effective. So that's fantastic. We know that. So as we move on, hopefully we'll see more education. And there are things that have been really, really positive. For example, Tasted is a great little program where young people at primary schools are rethinking their relationship with food through the senses. We know that lots of young people, something like 67% of young people's diets is highly processed food. So we need to shift away from that. We know the climate impact, the health impact, the animal welfare impact of these kind of diets. But unless we re-educate our tastes, let alone think about the impact financially, then we can't move forward. So Tasted is a great program for that kind of thing.
Yeah. Now, and you're sort of mentioning projects and programs and specific things. Is that what is most measurable? Because I'm wondering whether it's individual projects, which are fantastic. I mean, Carl's project is absolutely amazing. It's fantastic. But is it about specifics where focus is put on a specific project, or is it a question of trying to change states of mind, ways of talking, ways of teaching, curriculum inclusion, the language around it as well? Are the two things separate, or do they just need to be blended into one?
Well, they need to be blended, but let's face it, we need systemic change. If change is actually going to happen, we need systemic change at the, you know, amongst the whole, within the whole food system. It's all very well us banging that education drum, but what makes things a lot easier is if we've got our politicians and our governments and our big brands working towards ethical, sustainable, social justice, environmental justice, then that makes our job an awful lot easier, because it's difficult, it's messy, it's complicated to unpack. We don't want young people to have issues around food in that they're refusing to eat particular foods that perhaps their parents can only afford particular foods. So that causes all sorts of disruption within the family. We don't want children to have angst over particular foods and therefore go down kind of mental health with anorexia or bulimia or anything like that. So we have to tread really carefully around these issues, to ensure the welfare of our children, as well as seeing them as active agents.
Yeah. Okay, so Carl, Leif, you mentioned that you're engaging young people in farming and sustainable food through experiential learning. Can you be quite specific about what you do? What sort of programmes do you run, and how do you carry out this experiential learning?
Yeah, absolutely. And just to add to what Verity's just said, for us, it's about that lifelong journey and learning. So it's not just the work that's being done with primary schools. We seem to do a lot of work with primary schools in the UK. And I used to be an assistant head teacher of secondary school in central Birmingham. You know, you hear about all these fantastic opportunities that are provided for primary school children. And suddenly, either we think we've solved the issues and the challenges and we just have not, or suddenly we become in these exam factories and we forget about the real world that we're trying to prepare young people for. So that secondary age, that teenage age, is just as important. So at Leif, and specifically through our Leif education work then, we work to deliver the national curriculum or exam specification through experiential learning. So that could be, we go out onto farm, for example, and we work with hundreds of farmers across England and across Wales, and we would go and deliver your business studies A-level, for example, and we would shape the exam spec that we've got. It's not perfect. It doesn't talk about sustainable food production or sustainable food choices necessarily, but actually we've got this multi-billion pound industry. So let's look at it from that direction and bring in that understanding and that opportunity. Again, as part of our research, we asked a lot of young people, do you know what you want to be in the future? And just thinking, are we too late at this age group to think about careers? Well, actually, when young people came back, they said, oh, yeah, we know what we're doing. We know what we're doing for the future. Actually, what they'd chosen at that point was their GCSE or their A-level. They'd not even considered careers or themselves as a consumer. So also it's framing it with the group of young people you have in front of us. So equally then, we've worked this year with the John Innes Centre. And we've worked with them to develop a program to go into schools across East Anglia. And we've set up allotments with them. The schools have created them with their GCSE science groups and their A-level science groups. And we've looked at how we could intercrop wheat and legumes to increase nitrogen and nitrates within the soil. Doesn't necessarily scream the most exciting and the key thing that surely these GCSE level, A-level students want to do. But actually, it's all about sustainable wheat production, potentially bread production. So can we have a more secure wheat harvest, for example, in the UK? And could that produce more wheat for bread production? And actually, by framing it into a real piece of research that industry would be doing anyway, the agri-food industry would be doing, is absolutely of interest to those young people. And we've brought researchers in, so we've brought in those from the John Innes Centre to go and talk to those young people. Actually, we've now got those that are going on to university. Equally, we set up our first piece of research back in 2017, where the agri-food industry was constantly telling us as an organisation, but also young people, what they had to do and think and believe. And we were like, well, hang on a minute. In the education system, we ask young people, what do they believe? What do they want? And how do we engage? And so that's where we first went out. And part of the young people, it sounds quite simple, actually. We set up our first national competition for 14 to 16-year-olds to understand food, farming and the natural environment. And we took them for 3 days to a land-based college in North Wales, Clisfasi College. They had a dairy unit there. They had an agroforestry system. They had an arable system as well. And so we just took young people and gave them that experience to learn about where their food actually comes from, the people behind it, the technology behind it, and how it can become more sustainable as a system. In the first year, we thought, right, how do we engage? Are young people going to understand what we're doing over this weekend? So we started off with a hypothesis that young people argued for or against. Farming is so much more than mud and wellies. And actually, all of the young people that came that year were girls. A lot of them were from girls' grammar schools in the Midlands, private girls' schools. We didn't know who we were going to engage with. So it was really interesting to see who it was that entered. And actually, all of them said it was. And actually, by the end of the weekend, I think we're really tired after 3 days working full.
I'm not surprised.
5 a.m., they're up milking in the parlour. And we had one group of girls, actually, that came to us and said, where's the stall? And we said, what do you mean? They said, where's the three-legged stall to milk these cows? And we've got milk like this for decades. It's robotic. But, you know, it's... that's where these young people have that misconception. It's without giving them those experience. Actually, what we've seen since then, through these national competitions, we've looked at how can we ensure that our food system becomes carbon neutral by 2040. It was the NFEU's target. And we've focused around that. Last year, we looked at, is soil the answer and key to sustainable food production? So we've greatly gone into depth. And young people are keen to learn and keen to engage. Last year's competition, 50% of young people that came went on to land-based college and university, didn't even know it existed. Year before, two-thirds. We've always had a minimum of a third of young people. And actually, they're young people that we didn't even think, you know, some of the Welsh schools that had applied, we thought, well, maybe they've got a bit of background, family history, and they're the ones that have entered, but no, Central Manchester. We've had the outskirts of London. We've had up in Cumbria, and they've all entered without even understanding those opportunities that are open to them.
Yeah.
I, And I think that experiential is really important, really important. But unfortunately, a lot of our schools can't do that. So I'm just going to think about the primary sector just for a moment, because I'm doing some research at the moment. UWE and Cardiff University are working with schools in Wales, and we're working with primary schools and looking at how young people can navigate proteins and how proteins in our diet, the impact that they have on the health and also the environment, and what choices we can make and what choices there might be in the future. So we've worked with over 200 young people, and the idea is to get them to critically think in the classroom. What might this look like in the classroom? What kind of learning needs to take place for them to have that? And teachers have said that, you know, they're time poor, they're resource poor, they're subject knowledge poor. So what needs to be put in there? The young people have said, yeah, they absolutely want to learn about this. So based on World Health Organization and UN reports, we've put together resources that critically allow children to think about beef farming, insect farming and legume farming, to kind of talk with farmers in the UK that are part of those systems, and then kind of discuss, okay, so where are we at the beginning? We kind of thought beef was great, but we're not sure now. And everyone thought that kind of the idea of eating insects was absolutely disgusting. But okay, we can see the health and we can see the environmental aspects of that. And well, you know, I don't want to be a vegetarian or a vegan, but actually the legumes are really good. So we go through that whole process, that complex process, to start those conversations. And then, I mean, what would be ideal is if those children that we're working with at primary could then go on and have that experiential experience within farming as they go into secondary school.
So what we do is we also deliver online. So last year we worked with just under 40,000 young people on farm, in person, in the classroom through that direct delivery. But we reached just over 1 million young people through our online resources and our opportunities to engage, deliver bespoke virtual sessions. But all of my team are qualified teachers. And the first thing we say to teachers is, we're not here to add to your workload. We are going to take work from you. We're going to deliver national curriculum points. We're going to deliver exams, but we're going to do it in a different way. We're going to use food and farming to deliver it as the vehicle for that. But equally, we are very clear that we are there to provide young people with the information that they need in front of them to make choices. We're educators, we're not marketeers. We're there to provide fact-based learning, scientific-based learning, to then make those decisions that's appropriate for them. And very often in industry, we seem to have meat eaters versus non-meat eaters pitted against one another. Well, actually, we all require the food system to eat, regardless of your food choices. And we talk to young people about all these opportunities. And Verity, as you said at the start, those food choices at an early age and how they might affect your health and well-being, good and bad, and how you would develop that. So, for example, we might be talking on a beef farm and we might have a live butchery demonstration and we're looking around that. But equally, we would be very happy to have nutritionists supporting a vegan diet for teenage girls especially, and how that would have the right information for them to make informed decisions so it doesn't affect their health. So for us, it's always about having those open and honest conversations so young people can make those informed decisions.
So Verity, how can we incorporate concepts like food justice and equity into the education system to help young people understand the social aspects of sustainable food systems without boring their pants off? Because I've been in classrooms probably about 8 years ago when a big charity who does some fantastic work was trying to teach kids, and the language wasn't right. It was a finger wagging affair. It achieved the opposite of what was intended. Is it about the language? Is it about changing the way that you engage with them, or is it back to your idea of conquering reticence?
We need those hopeful pedagogies. We need the facts, we need the time, we need to reflect, we need the good practice, we need the time to engage with how we can engage. But we also need teachers who are informed and enabled. So for me, here at UWE, part of my job is training teachers. We have over 300 trainee teachers leave our doors every year. And that can provide an exponential impact on the amount of young people who are engaged with that over the next, you know, one, two, three, you know, every one of those 300 new teachers then have 30 students in their classroom. And that's and think of the impact that you can have on those 30 young people, and then another 30, or if you're at secondary, you know, way more than that, that you have a possibility for. So I think it's really important to be thinking in those terms. We've got 11 million young people of education age in the UK. And so our teachers are an amazing potential for that mouthpiece. But they need the training. They need the space in which to have that professional development. We need the resources available. And it's great to have external people coming in. But whether that is in and of itself sustainable, because they can't keep coming in. Yeah. So we need to make sure.
The sheer weight of traffic, yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. So we need to make sure that when these experts come in, that our teachers are using it almost like training by stealth. It's not official training, but they're in a classroom with an expert who's modelling how to teach these things, and they need to recognise that as part of that process.
But do we expect too much of teachers to solve problems that maybe the food industry or society in general should really be solving?
That goes back to that we need systemic change, absolutely. The weight of responsibility is just increasing and increasing on teachers. We have teachers who are leaving our profession in their droves because of the pressures that are brought on it. So, yeah, we absolutely need to look after our profession and not put weight on it. And food systems, I mean, Carl explained it beautifully, how you can use food systems in business, you can use food systems in maths and in English. Yeah, it's completely cross-curricular how you do this, but there's only so much time and space that our teachers can do that in.
Yeah, which is interesting, the way that Carl says they are taking the burden off teachers. We're doing this for you, you know, we're giving you this thing, which I guess makes a big difference. So I just want to pause this conversation to speak to Rosalind Rathouse. Now, Ros is founder of the Cookery School at Little Portland Street, and as such, you could say that she's on the front line of sustainability education. So welcome to the podcast, Ros.
Thanks. Hi, good to see you.
So the question for you really is, should we focus sustainability education on young people, or is it needed across all age groups?
Well, it's needed across all age groups, but I think starting at schools, in schools, is really important. In fact, I feel really strongly that the government should be doing something major about this. It's everyone just talks the talk and doesn't do the walk. It's really unacceptable, totally unacceptable. And you've got me on a favourite hobby horse.
So why is that? Why do we need it across? I mean, you know, what about an older generation as well? Do they still need to change their ways, do you think?
Yep. Okay. I think that one has to realise, first of all, just the very word. I wish there was a different word one could use instead of sustainability. I think the very word sustainability is really daunting. It seems like an enormous task. And we're always hearing people say, what difference does it make if I'm not sustainable? I'm only one person, which is exactly what we want them to say, because we always say to them, doesn't matter what you do, we teach a lot about sustainability. And our message is, it doesn't matter what you do or how small it is, because every tiny change that everyone makes is important, because it's like a river, tributaries running into a river. The more people that do something, clearly, the bigger the impact's going to be. And I think that's the first thing we always say to everyone, is don't think that you don't matter. But the more they know and the more they do, the more they matter, really. So one of the things that we're about to launch, actually, is something called sustainable kitchen training, because it's not domestic, but the restaurant industry really is in exactly the same boat. Guys just don't know, and when I say guys, the guys working in the kitchen simply do not know or want to know about sustainability in the main. Of course, you're going to get exceptions. And the most important thing is, before you begin talking about sustainability, you've got to get buy-in. unless you can excite people about sustainability, you don't have a chance, you don't stand a hope in hell of getting them to change. You've got to have that buy-in. So we, on our sustainable kitchen training, the first thing we do is a three-hour session with everyone in the kitchen. And you've got to be very careful when you're talking about sustainability that you're not preachy. It's very easy to be preachy. And it's about getting people to engage. It's to make them feel that, yeah, we understand what it's about. And in fact, we have a game. I'll show it to you sometime. We actually have produced our own game that has definitions on it, things that people are scared of. When they hear greenhouse gases, no one knows what they mean. Carbon footprint, they're very off-putting, those terms. So what we have is we have the term and we have additional definition, and they have to, and there's a picture that goes with the term. So even if you can't read, you can understand on the icon what we're trying to do. And then they marry them. There must be 25 of them. And they're very straightforward things, you know, recycling, recycled, recyclable, things that just baffle people. And we go through them. They all play this game. Everyone gets a pack of cards and they all match them. And they love doing that. And then we talk through what they are. And we say, it doesn't really matter because it's jargon, but it just helps you not be nervous anymore. Because you are now, you understand it. You're part of the whole process of understanding it. You're involved in it. And then we do some other exercises, like the journey of a seed. And people are absolutely horrified when they see the resources. Everyone chooses their own seed. And when we come again, we compare at the end. It's always a chat. It's open-ended. And all it is sort of just making them sit up and think for the first time about something they might not have considered. And when we've done it in the past for suppliers and our own staff, suppliers that have never thought about it have said, wow, we've come away and feeling like we can understand. And I think understanding is the key to starting this whole process. As soon as you have buy-in, I think you have people on board with you.
Yeah. Now, you're in close contact, obviously, with the learning process. You have people there that you're actually teaching. And I wondered if you could offer some specifics. Is there anything that you're surprised that people generally don't know, that they don't do, or they don't care enough about in the kitchen? Is it techniques? Is it specific ingredients? Is it food storage or food wastage? What is the one thing that you kind of think, why don't you people know this?
Wastage is a huge thing. Food wastage, I'd say, is probably the biggest thing of all. I don't know whether you know that just before lockdown, I was really impressed. First time I've been really impressed. The government, I don't know whether you knew about it at all, were doing a huge program on food waste for the whole country. Were you involved at all?
No, I wasn't. No.
It was super, super impressive. Takes quite a lot to make me think something's impressive. The things I didn't love were the things when they spoke about schools that had to fit in to the curriculum under certain numbers and formalities. And I used to just sit at a meeting and think, why the hell don't they just, every school across the country has got to devote 15 minutes per week or 15 minutes three times a week to doing something on sustainability in their assemblies. Something simple. So it wouldn't be taking away teaching time if they felt strongly about that, but just call it sustainability in the same way as I feel that they should have a subject just called cooking, not associated with food tech or rubbish like that. Just cook for the sheer joy of it from the word go. And
My only ever conversation was with Liz Truss was when she was chairing a meeting about the new qualifications, and we were discussing, and I said, why don't you just call it cooking? But it's all far too complicated. Oh no, you wouldn't want to do that because then it's not technology, and parents won't buy into it. And I think, oh come on, everyone loves cooking.
Yeah, and when you talk to chefs, it's exactly the same. It comes from a chefing angle. We have a blueprint. In fact, we've got two projects at the moment. The one is our blueprint on teaching people to cook We know we can teach someone to cook decently in 5 days. Just, they can go away and cook. It's 20 hours. If you actually think how easy it is to learn to cook, you need to do certain basic things. Once you've got them, you can extrapolate that technique to anything else, provided, the key is provided you understand. And in all the discussions that everyone is having, whether it's about the fats and salts that we're eating, the junk food, or health, gut health, whatever it may be, obesity, there's one factor. They all say, yeah, people should cook. But unless you actually address it, no one is ever going to cook. It's all very well. Yeah.
And once you start cooking, a load of these other things just fall into place anyway. Once you understand the stuff you're dealing with, how it functions in the kitchen, the rest of it is a much easier thing to learn, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, I always think of myself as a walking, an 80-year-old document that's a walking document, because I've watched 50 years of such changes in food. When I came to live in England 60 years ago, even if you couldn't cook and you opened a tin of bully beef, you had to open it and put it in a frying pan if you wanted to melt the fat.
Still had to cook it.
You couldn't just go and buy a ready meal. Or if you bought one of those horrible Fray Bentos pies that you opened with a tin and then you put it in the oven and it puffed, you had to put it into the oven and let it puff. It was there was an element of cooking in it. And I've watched over 50 years as teaching about cooking has dropped out of the curriculum completely. Even though it was terrible in the early days and they were using margarine. I mean, the 50s was just, the food was ghastly. And I've just watched the food revolution over the years. It's been so exciting. But I've also watched the demise of so much else that was good that has gone.
Yeah. Well, let's bring this back to sustainability. Yeah.
Sustainability,
full disclosure here.
Yeah, coming back to sustainability, it's exactly the same principle. You get people to understand the issue. I mean, my background's in teaching, and it was in teaching adolescents that didn't like learning. So I always had to find a shortcut to make them learn. And the minute they understood the topic, I didn't know the subject. They'd have to explain it to me or we'd work on it together. And the minute they understood the topic and they could take ownership of it, you were home and dry. And it's exactly the same principle. You let people understand whatever it is. No jargon, you cut through all the crap and they just get it. And I think that that applies to sustainability. And there's no excuse, at the level of government, of setting it aside. I think they've just got to do something. I think bottom up is very important and a lot of people are doing it. But there's nothing that's overarching. It's disparate. So we're all doing our little bit. But you need more than that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, full disclosure here. Rosalind is the mother of one of my best mates from university, Bridget. And my wife went on one of her courses at the cookery school. Now, one of the most interesting, and she, you know, it was brilliant. She absolutely loved every minute of it. So thank you so much for having her. The big thing that I took from it was watching her, which is something that I know haven't done before. She now cooks with a bowl for the waste there. And I think that this is one of the simple things that people can do in kitchens, which is a visual representation of everything that you haven't used. You keep that bowl on the table, and all of the waste, all of the offcuts that you're going to throw away, go into a bowl rather than straight into a bin. And having it there is a brilliant visualization of the fact you are wasting food. And I think that alone is just one little thing that anyone could do. Now, Roz, the cookery schools received the highest possible rating for sustainability from the Sustainable Restaurant Association. It's been pretty much...
Well, it did.
It did.
It did. We don't belong. We haven't belonged for a good few years because I think they're brilliant and I think they're doing really great things, particularly with bigger groups, chains that didn't do anything. And I think that's their strength. They weren't set up to deal with cookery schools. And we decided our credentials on our own were strong enough not to need anyone else. We've been doing it for 21 years. When we first started, that was before the SRA, I believe. Everyone used to think we were cranky. I have another daughter that you don't know, Catherine, who's an environmental psychologist, always interested in the environment from the time she was at school. And she was the person that nagged me and introduced me to it, I don't know how many years, 30, 40 years ago. So it's sort of, it's nice when you're trained by your children, you know. And so when cookery school started, it started with that sort of emphasis on sustainability. And there were certain things we just never did. If we couldn't get anything that was organic for good reason, not just because it was cool to be organic, but the fact that vegetables were correctly grown without fertilizers and so on, we just didn't use them. And the same principle has gone through all the way for the last 21 years. And in the early days, the only supermarket we could buy from was Waitrose. They were really market leaders. Everyone else is doing the same thing now. But even with the COVID, it's been quite hard, actually, to find organic produce, to find any produce since Brexit, but more particularly organic produce. But so we still, if we can't get it, we don't use it.
Yeah. Now, just one last question, really. Do you have any really good specific and practical advice for educators who are trying to get younger people specifically to care about sustainability? I think the waste bowl on the kitchen table is my absolute favourite. But what else have you found is particularly effective?
Well, interestingly, what we find is when we have kids on the course, we do quite a lot of schools. We have a principle of never turning down a school. Even if they don't have money, they come in for a short while because education of children is critical. But they are very wised up, a lot of them, just because I think they fear for the future. They're far more knowledgeable than adults. And that always surprises me. So I think that thing that they have, I mean, I think Greta Thunberg has had a huge influence on a lot of children. I think she's amazing. And I think the younger generation generally are more aware of the environment than are the older generation. You can't speak in generalizations, but I would say from our experience. But I think if you take that and you enhance what they already know, and give them even more power and more knowledge. I think, you know, there's so many things that they can learn, like using a hob instead of a cooker and the reason for it because of the use of energy, using good energy. And the more people that use good energy, the cheaper it's becoming, as you know. I mean, there are things that are just really basic, simple things they can do. Not wasting, you know, they're all the obvious things we know. That at the end of the day, the trouble is, it's an ethical decision, isn't it? And everyone has different degrees to which they go that they believe are correct, is a correct level of sustainability.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, Rosalind Rathouse from the Cookery School at Little Portland Street, thank you so much for your time.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.
Now, we have a game-driven young population. And I'm just going to put this out here. I mean, obviously, I'm not the educational specialist here. But what about the use of technology, mobile apps, gamification, virtual reality, augmented reality? I mean, we're talking about food here. Food is a hands-on or a sensory experience. You know, can you use these other tools which are not hands-on to get people to care about what they eat? Carl, why didn't you start with an answer on that?
I think it's certainly part of the toolkit, if you like, but food absolutely touches every sense, and the gamification of industry, I think, does take away some of that joy and love, actually, of food and the sector. And we've used augmented reality in some of the workshops that we've delivered, and it's lovely and it's great and it's really fun, but it still doesn't touch on reality. Actually, when I was head of faculty, I remember Google came in. It was at the time where they just started creating these VR headsets. I remember I surveyed all of the young people in our secondary school, and I said, would you rather do field work? And we can almost do it weekly. You know, we can go up the Burj Khalifa, we can go see the Northern Lights, and we'll do it all through virtual reality headsets. Or would you prefer that in-person experiential learning? Well, guess what I'm going to say? They all wanted experiential learning. Absolutely has its place. It absolutely does. It's part of that toolkit. It's a part of that opportunity. It's very to say, you know, experiential learning for some people is just not an opportunity. It's not an opportunity. There isn't the logistics and the physicality of doing that and cost.
I'm thinking about the risk assessment.
No. Well, if you wear VR headsets too long, you end up getting travel sick as well. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay.
And don't get into the gender of it. VR headsets are designed for men rather than women. So there's all sorts of issues that go with that. But absolutely. What I would add to that is I've recently been doing some research with a European team, and we're looking at digital citizenship and how young people use their phones or use different platforms in order to engage with protest, with the things that they are impassioned about and value. And I think that is one way that we can really encourage young people to engage with food systems. So I do lots of work, not only about food systems, I also do stuff about fashion and fast fashion. And one of the things that we ask a lot of young people to do is contact the brand and say, you know, who made my clothes? What's in my clothes? Where are my clothes from? And, you know, what brands have said is for one person who asked the question, that in their minds equates to 2,000 people thinking it. So if you enact that, not boycott, but that voice and enable that amplification of the voice and the questioning, then that's really powerful. And I think our young people are really switched on to that. And I think that's how we can perhaps enable some action and agency.
But equally, our food system is becoming more technologically advanced. So, you know, where is the crossover? I remember at one point in our national competition, actually, a group of students came back and said, what we've learned from this weekend is actually you can almost farm from your mobile phone and produce food from your mobile phone.
I was going to say that those muddy boots, maybe not so much anymore.
Yeah. When they turned around, they said, look, you as the judges here in the audience, I was thinking, I'm only 35, thank you, but okay. You're new to this technology. You know, you weren't born with a mobile phone in your hand. We are. We're used to it. And this is the direction it's going in. So, yeah.
And also concepts of reality are relative, I would say, aren't they? Okay, last question then for both of you. Let's look at 2050. Young people being educated now will be middle-aged adults. Some of them may be leading the fight against climate change. Maybe we'll have solved it. Who knows? I suspect not. What's the one change that you hope will have happened by then? Because in my reading of it, I was very negative about you know what's happening. But you both seem very positive, and which is really exciting. And I think you're absolutely right, especially Verity with your saying it's got, you know, we've got to stop it being overwhelming. It's got to be aspirational. I completely get it. So what are we aiming at? What do you hope will be achieved, and how will education get us there? Verity, if you can start with that.
Well, I think Carla said it beautifully in the experiential stuff. We need education to be experiential. I'm really excited to be part of Sparks Bristol, which is a sustainable department store in the heart of Bristol. And we've got the different departments, and we have kind of rethought out what a department store might look like. So we have got a food department, we've got a fashion department, we've got an electrics department, and people come in, but instead it's pre-loved or it's secondhand or it's mended. But the food is local, the food is seasonal, the food is by small producers. So that kind of...
That's all just so Bristol as well, isn't it? I love you people.
Very Bristol. And please, everyone come. We're doing school visits, we do workshops, all sorts of really exciting things. And I think it's those kind of things that are set in the heart of the community that really celebrate what food can be like, what alternative futures could look like. And having examples of those, I think, would be phenomenal to see. But I also think that, I mean, you know, we just keep going back to it. We need systemic change. We need a shift away from those ultra processed foods. We need more kind of engagement with our own senses about that. And somehow we need to kind of make sense of the mess and the complicatedness, the politics. I was talking to a group just the other day about palm oil, that they'd come into Sparks and they wanted to talk about palm oil. And they'd done a whole session, you know, a whole term of palm oil. They were year eight, but they'd never seen what palm oil looked like. And they were shocked to find out that because of the Ukraine war, The Nestle, who make cereals, who usually use sunflower oil in their cereals, because of the Ukraine war, sunflower oil is no longer available, so they're returning to palm oil. And it's that complicated, contextualized education that we're having to look at and unpack and unpick and think about, well, what does that mean to me now? So all of that is really difficult to navigate.
Absolutely. Carl, 25 years' time, what are you hoping will have happened by then in terms of climate action, and how would integral and how would education be integral to achieving that?
So for me, it's that there's a greater value put in our food system, and that there's a need for food security at the heart of our decision making as a country. We're the only country that seems to be in the world that doesn't put food security actually at the centre. Education has that role to play. It's not fear-mongering. Mongering at all, as we said in the early stages, it's empowering those young people. I think the education system is the way to deliver that, to inform our future consumer, but it's wider than just school-based education. There's a wider societal education piece to have, and the need to reach out to wider society through that as well.
And let's not forget, there are 4 million people working in food and agriculture in the UK, and there's a £151 billion turnover.
Yep.
You know, this is not a small system. You know, it's huge, and it needs to be drawn the right way.
Exactly.
And it needs to be sustainable for everyone for the future.
But ultimately...
Okay.
Oh, sorry, Steph.
No, go on.
Ultimately as well, that sustainable food choices should be seen as the norm and not a choice. At the moment, it feels very much that it is a choice. You either... buy or you don't buy sustainable food produce, but actually it should just be centre stage. That should absolutely be at the centre of our food system.
Yeah. Now, one last question. I promised you that was the last question, but I've got another one. I'm really sorry. So I mean, you two are both involved in extraordinary kind of nudge projects, helping people to make better choices, making something aspirational. Is that going to succeed on its own, or do we need the push approach as well? Do we need regulation and taxes and for the food industry to be forced to do things that make food more sustainable? Verity?
I think that, again, you started with a really interesting question, and that's another really interesting question. And, you know, we are in both a climate and ecological emergency, and we're in a health emergency. And it's all related to food. It's, you know, we're all in it together, and we need to think about, you know, what does that mean, and how can we act? And I like to look at smoking as an example. So, you know, tobacco was introduced in the 16th century. And by 1604, James the Sixth actually said it's really bad for the lungs and put a tax on it back then in 1604. And then that was lifted because it was impeding the American colonies in America. Now, if we'd have listened to him back then, let alone all of the research that was done, you know, back in the 60s, we knew then it was linked to cancer. And still now, today, we've got e-cigarettes with nicotine in, and we've got all of the issues, 8 million lives are lost each year with tobacco, 600 million trees every year are cut down, 22 billion tons of water, 84 million tons of CO2, all linked with tobacco. Now, the food system is, you know, really similar to that. It's linked with colonialism. It's linked with this long history of unjust power systems. And I think we need to kind of think about it in those kind of terms.
Yeah. Now, Carl, I would say that you're in a slightly different situation because your organisation is integrated with the food industry. Is that the food industry doing its best to fight off what the inevitable regulation that might come its way? Or do we just need to see more projects like you've got and better funded?
I think in terms of the sustainable food system, what we are finding as an organisation is in the last 3 years, it has grown exponentially. The retailers that we're working with, the brands that we're working with, they want to be more sustainable. They are looking at their food systems. We as an organisation, Linking Environment and Farming Leaf, have been around for over 31 years. We've been arguing for this for years. But certainly the last 3 years feels absolutely our time. The agri-food industry are listening. Government, we would love them to go further. We'd love them to do more. Is it regulation, or is it just knowing that it's the right thing to do, actually? And sometimes that's just as powerful than being told what to do. The fact that nearly every retailer in the UK now has committed to leaf mark in the fresh produce, we work in other areas as well, and so there's still growth to be had, is a really positive sign that we are doing the right thing, and not just in the UK, but internationally through our supply chains. Of course, there's more still to be done. But I think at the moment, it feels like we're doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do, rather than being told that you have to do this. Obviously, all the evidence there is telling us we should be doing this. But whether it's legislation and tax, I'm not sure at this moment in time.
And we also have to be wary of greenwashing when the brands, it's all very well them saying, oh, yes, we're doing this and we've got this mark. But actually, there's transparency there. And then as consumers, we're once again having to kind of pick our way through that. I mean, there's some great apps that we can use that you know, you can go onto barcodes and see where things are coming from. But all of that is developing.
And the natural corollary of this is developing sustainability labelling, which is in a whole other
kind
of worms we can discuss.
We have LEED Mark sustainable food produce. It's on packaging. It's been white labelled for years, but now retailers say that actually consumer are looking for it. And part of the research, young people are saying, well, actually, we want that really visible on packaging. Instead of having kind of a gluten-free aisle, why haven't we got a sustainable food aisle? For example, aisles, it should be.
Well, maybe we will. I think that's an exciting development. Fantastic. Well, Carl Edwards and Verity Jones, this has been a brilliant conversation. It's funnier than I was expecting, but also packed full of information. So thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.